As he waited for the trial to begin, Blomqvist glanced around at the other spectators. He caught sight of Armansky sitting near the exit, and their eyes met for a moment. Ekstrom had a large stack of papers on his table. He greeted several journalists. Giannini sat at her table across from Ekstrom. She had her head down and was sorting through her papers. Blomqvist thought his sister looked a bit tense. Stage fright, he supposed. Then the judge-assessor and lay assessors entered the courtroom. Judge Jorgen Iversen was a white-haired, 57-year-old man with a gaunt face and a spring in his step. Blomqvist had researched Iversen's background and found that he was an exacting judge of long experience who had presided over many high-profile cases. Finally, Salander was brought into the courtroom. Even though Blomqvist was used to Salander's penchant for shocking clothing, he was amazed that his sister had allowed her to show up to the courtroom in a black leather miniskirt with frayed seams and a black top, with the legend "I am annoyed," which barely covered her many tattoos. She had 10 piercings in her ears and a ring through her left eyebrow. Her head was covered in 3 months' worth of uneven stubble after her surgery. She wore grey lipstick and more black mascara than Blomqvist had ever seen her wear. Her eyebrows were heavily darkened. In the days when he and Salander had spent time together, she had shown almost no interest in makeup. She looked a bit vulgar, to put it mildly. It was almost a goth look. She reminded him of a vampire in some pop art movie from the 60s. Blomqvist was aware of some of the reporters in the press gallery catching their breath in astonishment or smiling broadly. They were at last getting a look at the scandal-ridden young woman they had written so much about, and she was certainly living up to all their expectations. Then he realized that Salander was in costume. Usually her style was sloppy and rather tasteless. Blomqvist had assumed that she was not really interested in fashion, but that she tried instead to accentuate her own individuality. Salander had always seemed to mark her private space as hostile territory, and he had thought of the rivets in her leather jacket as a defense mechanism, like the quills of a hedgehog. To everyone around her, it was as good a signal as any. "Don't try to touch me, it will hurt." But here in the district court, she had exaggerated her style to the point of parody. It was no accident. It was part of Giannini's strategy. If Salander had come in with her hair smoothed down and wearing a twin set and pearls and sensible shoes, she would have come across as a con artist trying to sell a story to the court. It was a question of credibility. She had come as herself and no one else. Way over the top. For clarity. She was not pretending to be someone she was not. Her message to the court was that she had no reason to be ashamed or to put on a show. If the court had a problem with her appearance, it was no concern of hers. The state had accused her of a multitude of things, and the prosecutor had dragged her into court. With her very appearance, she had already indicated that she intended to brush aside the prosecutor's accusations as nonsense. She moved with confidence and sat down next to her lawyer. She surveyed the spectators. There was no curiosity in her gaze. She seemed instead to be defiantly observing and registering those who had already convicted her in the press. It was the first time Blomqvist had seen her since she lay like a bloody rag doll on the bench in that kitchen in Gossaberger, and a year and a half or more since he had last seen her under normal circumstances. If the term "normal circumstances" could ever be used in connection with Salander. For a matter of seconds, their eyes met. Hers lingered on him, but she betrayed no sign of recognition. Yet she did seem to study the bruises that covered Blomqvist's cheek and temple, and the surgical tape over his right eyebrow. Blomqvist thought he discerned the merest hint of a smile in her eyes, but could not be sure he had not imagined it. Then Judge Iversen pounded his gavel and called the court to order. The spectators were allowed to be present in the courtroom for all of 30 minutes. They listened to Ekstrom's introductory presentation of the case. Every reporter except Blomqvist was busily taking notes, even though by now all of them knew the charges Ekstrom intended to bring. Blomqvist had already written his story. Ekstrom's introductory remarks went on for 22 minutes. Then it was Giannini's turn. Her presentation took 30 seconds. Her voice was firm. "The defense rejects all the charges brought against my client, except one. She admits to possession of an illegal weapon, that is, one spray canister of mace. to all other counts, my client pleads not guilty of criminal intent. We will show that the prosecutor's assertions are flawed and that my client has been subjected to grievous violations of her civil rights. I will demand that my client be acquitted of all charges, that her declaration of incompetence be revoked, and that she be released. There was a murmuring from the press gallery. Advocate Giannini's strategy had at last been revealed. It was obviously not what the reporters had been expecting. Most had speculated that Giannini would in some way exploit her client's mental illness to her advantage. Blomqvist smiled.
"I see,"
Judge Everson said, making a swift note. He looked at Giannini.
"Are you finished?"
"That is my presentation."
"Does the prosecutor have anything to add?"
Judge Everson said. It was at this point that Ekstrom requested a private meeting in the judge's chambers. There he argued that the case hinged upon one vulnerable individual's mental state and welfare, and that it also involved matters which, if explored before the public in court, could be detrimental to national security.
"I assume that you are referring to what may be termed the Zalichenko affair,"
Judge Everson said.
"That is correct. Alexander Zalichenko came to Sweden as a political refugee and sought asylum from a terrible dictatorship. There are elements in the handling of his situation, personal connections and the like, that are still classified, even though Herr Zalichenko is now deceased. I therefore request that the deliberations be held behind closed doors and that a rule of confidentiality be applied to those sections of the deliberations that are particularly sensitive."
"I believe I understand your point," Judge Everson said, knitting his brows.
"In addition, a large part of the deliberations will deal with the defendant's guardianship. This touches on matters which in all normal cases become classified almost automatically, and it is out of respect for the defendant that I am requesting a closed court."
"How does Advocate Giannini respond to the prosecutor's request?"
"For our part, it makes no difference." Judge Everson consulted his assessor and then returned to the courtroom and announced, to the annoyance of the reporters present, that he had accepted the prosecutor's request. So Blomqvist left the courtroom.
Armansky waited for Blomqvist at the bottom of the stairs in the courthouse. It was sweltering in the July heat, and Blomqvist could feel sweat in his armpits. His two bodyguards joined him as he emerged from the courthouse. Both nodded to Armansky and then busied themselves studying the surroundings.
"It feels strange to be walking around with bodyguards,"
Blomqvist said.
"What's all this going to cost?"
"It's on the firm. I have a personal interest in keeping you alive. But since you ask, we've spent roughly 250,000 kroner on pro bono work in the past few months."
"Coffee?" Blomqvist said, pointing to the Italian cafe on Bergsgarten. Blomqvist ordered a latte and Armansky a double espresso with a teaspoon of milk. They sat in the shade on the sidewalk outside. The bodyguards sat at the next table drinking cokes.
"Closed court," Armansky said.
"That was expected. And it's okay, since it means that we can control the news flow better."
"You're right. It doesn't matter to us. But my opinion of Prosecutor Ekstrom is sinking fast," Armansky said.
They drank their coffee and contemplated the courthouse in which Salander's future would be decided.
"Custer's last stand," Blomqvist said.
"She is well prepared," Armansky said. "And I must say I'm impressed with your sister. When she began planning her strategy, I thought it made no sense, but the more I think about it, the more effective it seems."
"This trial won't be decided in there," Blomqvist said.
He had been repeating these words like a mantra for several months.
"You're going to be called as a witness," Armansky said.
"I know. I'm ready.
But it won't happen before the day after tomorrow. At least that's what we're counting on.